honour of introducing you before you speak.
Thank you, John. Just be dishonest. Yeah.
You're almost ready?
Yeah. Shall we?
Well, welcome back. Good morning. I'm John Ewer from the Parliamentary Studies Centre at the Australian National University. Welcome back those who were here yesterday to our dawn service as we start even earlier than we did yesterday. And a special welcome for those who weren't here yesterday. We are on the second leg of a two-legged voyage. Yesterday we had an opportunity to learn a lot about the Australian experience of bicameralism, in particular Canberra, but then moving into the States and learning from people who manage the process, elected members and officials. Today we continue the journey of trying to locate the Australian experience in a wider comparative context. We started that with Professor Herr and Dr. Sherlock yesterday afternoon, taking us into the region, and we go further afield, crossing the hemisphere, crossing the equator, with Professor Anthony Mugen opening our presentations today with an address on 10 things you should know about the contemporary world of bicameralism. Before we get there, I just draw to the attention of our international visitors the fact that the dollar is falling, which is probably a great asset to them, to know that the Australian dollar is falling and that their purchasing power is immensely greater than it was when they booked their passage here. But while the dollar might be falling, the Australian National University, our sponsor, is rising. If you look at the front page of today's Australian, not only the news about Ricky Ponting, the cricket captain, but also a headline here, ANU pips Stanford. So that's very serious bit of cultural cringe work going on here. Further into the Australian, there's a photograph of my CEO, my Vice-Chancellor, Professor Chubb, lounging back in his chair, drawing the world's attention to the fact that the ANU is comfortably number 20 in the world in the Times higher education rating. The Times is like the Westminster Standard. It's the kind of where we look when we're trying to rate parliaments. Westminster seems to always emerge, and when we're trying to rate universities, the Times standard seems to be at least the one the ANU rates more highly on, so that's our preferred standard. We can worry about the local dollar, but I draw your attention to the rising stocks. Also should draw that to the attention of Michael Bohm, too, who had some not altogether wholesome comments about the Australian National University yesterday. Anthony Mugen, Director of the International Studies Program at Ohio State University, PhD in political science from the University of Iowa, which is one of the engine rooms of legislative studies in the United States. Expert on political parties, mass media, elections and political behaviour. Amongst Anthony's books, Media and the Presidentialization of Parliamentary Elections, bringing together the two worlds of presidential politics and parliamentary politics. Democracy in the Media, a Comparative Perspective. Political Leadership in Democratic Societies, edited with Samuel Patterson, a giant in the world of legislative politics. And then a book highly regarded by some of us in the room, Senates, Bicameralism in the Contemporary World. Samuel Patterson and Anthony Mugen edited a series of country reports from around the world. Anthony spent some time at the Australian National University, I think, 85 to 88, around that time? And as soon as this building was open, he left. So this is a wonderful opportunity 20 years later to bring him back here and as part of our dawn service to speak on contemporary bicameralism. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank John for bringing me back. It's a pleasure to visit Canberra again, especially in such glorious weather. My lasting memory of Canberra is blue skies. And I haven't been denied them this time around. I'd also like to thank you for turning up for this. Let me just say, this talk is really meant for a general audience. It's a synthetic overview of some of the major characteristics of bicameralism, bicameral institutions. And I've tried to pitch it as bringing up a talk that will bring up some of the issues that will be addressed at greater length in the country studies that will come later today, the individual country studies. So it's kind of, you might call it bicameralism 101. But having said that, let me start. I'll try to be quick since we're behind time, and I'd also like to leave some time for questions if there are any. Let's start with just the incidence of bicameralism. Last week, I went onto the Inter-Parliamentary Union website. There are 190 countries in the world today that have parliaments, 190 states that have parliaments. 76 of them, or 40%, are bicameral. So unicameralism is actually the more, across the globe, is the more common. Of these 76 bicameral states, 19 or 25% are federal. So again, perhaps counterintuitively, upper houses are greater in number in unitary states. It has to be said that virtually all federal states have an upper house, of course, but in terms of just simple numbers, simple counts, unitary states more commonly have an upper house. It's also worth noting that if we look at the third wave of democracies, those countries that have become democracies since about 1974, the third wave begins really with the democratization of Portugal, Spain, and Greece in the early 1970s. There are 68 new democracies in the world. Just over 38% of them are bicameral. So bicameralism is not becoming any more common in democratic societies, but it's not really becoming any less common either. What this might indicate is that the incidence of bicameralism is very much a function of the unique circumstances of individual countries as they choose to move in a particular political direction. Okay. So what I'd like to turn to now are the powers. There's immense variation in bicameral institutions. It's not unreasonable to say no two are the same. And this is particularly true if we look at the powers of upper and lower houses in bicameral countries. The distribution of power between lower and upper houses ranges from equality. Americans write co-equality. I'm not sure whether that's meaningful. But so you have countries, obviously like the US Senate, but also Italy has a very powerful upper house. In Italy, the upper house has to endorse new governments. It can bring and plays a role in bringing new governments down. And at the other end of the scale, we have upper houses with much more limited powers, usually the least powerful being the power of delay over non-financial legislation. And here we tend to think of the British House of Lords, which has a 12-month delaying power. But actually, the Irish Senate has 3 months, the Spanish Senate has only 2 months of delaying power. So there's huge range. These are the two extremes, are equality and then kind of simple powers of delay. The way that differences are reconciled between the two houses is also varies. There are two basic formulae. One is conference committees, whereby members of the two houses to get together and try to hammer out a piece of compromise legislation that encompasses the major interests of the two houses. And the other is the navette. A bill simply shuttles between the two houses until a compromise version is reached. Overall, though, it is the case that the lower houses generally rule the roost. Even in Italy, where there is there are co-equal houses, the lower house has generally accepted a inferior status to the upper house. And one, the explanation of this that being put forward in this book, at least, is that the public preference is for a weaker upper house, a house of review, rather than a co-equal house. And so even in Italy, there has been talk of abolishing the upper house. So, despite the huge variation in the powers of upper houses across the world, I suppose there is one commonality which applies by and large, which is that the lower house is the subordinate house, is the inferior house. The exception here, of course, is the United States, where, if anything, the Senate is taken to be the more powerful upper house, and even has reserved powers. The Senate, for example, approves Supreme Court justices, approves the appointment of diplomats overseas. What else do upper houses generally have in common? And the second, and in many ways most interesting common feature of upper houses is that they are what I call essentially contested institutions. By this, I mean that the very existence of upper houses is inherently in dispute. Some countries choose not to have an upper house. Some countries have chosen, New Zealand and Sweden are among the more prominent examples, have chosen to abolish the upper house. But in virtually all cases, the role and future of the upper house is constantly in debate. Perhaps we'll hear about this this afternoon from Meg Russell. Perhaps the archetypal example of this at the moment is the British House of Lords, where Mr. Blair found it relatively simple by ordinary legislation to change the membership of the House. But it's been proven much more difficult to decide how new members will become members of that House. Election appointment, direct election appointment, indirect election, etc. I think there are three nice quotes which reflect this ambiguous status of upper houses, the kind of not contempt is too strong a word, but the skepticism with which lower houses view upper houses. We had one was mentioned yesterday when Paul Keating called the Australian Senate the unrepresentative swill of Australian politics. Prime Minister Mulroney of Canada once described senators in his country as have-beens and never-was. And Robin Cook, who's now dead but former foreign minister, I think Mr. Blair's first foreign secretary, described the upper house, that cast of a Gilbert and Sullivan opera in the House of Lords. So there's the kind of the basic nature of upper houses is that they are essentially contested. And I think this comes from their functions And the principal functions that they perform are two, representation and redundancy. And in the performance of both of these functions, they find themselves vying for influence and power with the lower house. Let me just talk a little more about these two functions. Representation. Really, the question here is which groups should be protected against the potential majority tyranny of the lower house? Which groups should be which groups' interests should be protected in a democracy against the directly elected lower house? Initially, see the UK, France, Spain, and Italy. The answer to this question was largely class-based. The upper house emerged as a means of allowing the aristocratic class to protect its interests. In democratic times, the basis of representation is most commonly territorial. This is obviously this accounts for the almost complete correlation between federalism and bicameralism. And in some countries, a second basis of representation is ethnic linguistic minorities. Belgium, for example, has reformed its Senate to allow for the representation of the interests of largely geographically defined French speakers and Flemish speakers in Belgium, and in doing so has weakened the Senate as popularly elected institutions within the language communities have arisen to articulate their interests, and as more and more functions of central government have devolved to the language communities in Belgium. So, in fact, the whole of Belgium is now designed to represent the interests of the language minority. Even the political parties have split along linguistic lines, and the linguistic wings, French-speaking, Dutch-speaking wings of the parties, they operate entirely as independent parties. Sometimes even with one wing entering the government coalition, the other staying out. So the representative function is probably the less important. Well, not more than probably. The representative function is the less important of the two functions, and this is because, as we see vividly in Australia, upper houses are dominated by party considerations, political party considerations, and voting does not take place along regional lines, it takes place more along partisan lines. This is even found in Germany with the Bundesrat, which is supposed to be kind of the archetypal state house in at least among Western upper houses. So the question of representation, while very important initially, has tended to recede in an era of partisan parliamentary politics. The second major function of upper houses is redundancy. And this is what we refer to through phrases like House of Review. The idea is the second chamber provides for a second opinion, makes for improved deliberation, makes for improved legislation. And in doing so, again, performs the important function of preventing the excesses of the lower house from, but makes less likely the lower house's kind of imposition of majoritarianism on minority interests. Madison, for example, argued that the lower house might be liable to, and here I quote, liable to err from fecklessness and passion, and that a second chamber would provide a necessary fence against this danger. The problem here, of course, is that in vying for influence and power, the upper house becomes a enemy or a competitor with the lower house. This competition is resolved in one of three ways. The lower house simply overrides the upper house's objections after some kind of reasonable period. So this is what Dr. Spurlock yesterday was talking about in the case of Indonesia, where the upper house DPD might make suggestions to the lower house as to how legislation can be improved, what kind of amendments should be incorporated so as to make it kind of a fairer bill or whatever. But ultimately, it's the preserve of the lower house to accept those amendments or reject them. This is a case in the House of Lords, for example. In a second source of reconciliation is actually an upper house veto. The Bundesrat has the final say, for example, in disputes between state and federal governments. And this final say affects over 50% of legislation in the German political system. And then the final way that these kind of conflicts are resolved is that this bill simply dies. Perhaps new elections are called. In the US Senate, committee chairs have the power simply to shelve a bill so that it never sees the light, of day again. This is what happened, for example, with civil rights legislation, 1950s and 1960s. It was just not brought to the floor for debate. Shelved by southern senators whose longevity through the seniority system had given them pretty much control over all the important committees in the Senate. So the point I'm trying to make is that the essentially contested nature of upper houses comes from the upper house's performance of these two functions, and it leads to a permanent tension between lower and upper houses, because lower houses in some ways appreciate the lower houses in some ways appreciate the work done by upper houses because it does improve legislation. It improves representational basis of parliaments. But at the same time, they find themselves conflicting. Similarly with the representational function, lower houses often find themselves at odds with upper houses over whose interests are represented. It was commonly argued of the British House of Lords, for example, that it was really, was it the Conservative Party at prayer? That the House of Lords was basically a Conservative institution with a small c that maintained a social system that benefited the Conservative Party. And this is why Labour tried to reform the House of Lords root and branch in 1949, failed, and now it's one of the reasons Mr. Blair is trying to do it. So a permanent agenda item in democratic societies, in particular, is reform of the upper house, so as to make it more compatible with the wishes of the lower house. Reform, however, has proven to be quite difficult for a number of reasons. One, most upper houses are constitutionally vested. I mean, it's not often that a prime minister or a president gets the opportunity that Mr. Blair did simply to revolutionise the membership of the House of Lords by ordinary legislation. No special majorities were needed, no concurrent approval from the upper house. A second reason that we see lots of talk of reform, but not much reform, of course, is that it involves the interplay of vested interests. I mean, even though lower houses might rail against upper houses have their defenders. They have their uses. And so it's not always easy to mobilise the concurrent majorities needed for reform. And in this sense, perhaps it might be easier to abolish upper houses than to reform them. So I think, let me just by way of summarising what I'm saying, the upper houses defy generalisation, I think, except in these two areas. Generally speaking, they are inferior. Well, they are subordinate to the lower house. Most of the time, that is the case in terms of constitutional specification. But even where the Constitution allows for equality, upper houses seem, and again the exception here might be the U.S. Senate, upper houses seem to accept the preeminence of the lower house. The other, I mean, far more interesting and important generalized characteristic of upper houses is that they are essentially contested institutions. I mean, there was when Senator Faulkner gave his talk here yesterday morning, one of the themes was that in the sense that the ALP had reconciled itself to the Senate after a long period of at the very least feeling uncomfortable with it. In Britain at the moment, there is huge debate on whether members of the upper house should be directly elected, indirectly elected, appointed. I think that the best way to think of upper houses is that they are in continuous state of tension, continuous state of introspection, and continuously the object of at least desires for reform on the part of lower houses that have this ambivalent attitude towards them because they perform useful functions, even relatively powerless upper houses like the British House of Lords performed useful functions, but in performing these functions, they were often brought into conflict, tension with the lower house. And I think that's about it, John.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you. You'll remember yesterday morning when Senator Faulkner opened, he was shy, didn't want to take questions, didn't want to hold up our program, didn't want to get in the way of the panel that was immediately following. We understood that. But Tony's happy to take questions. He does want to stand in the way. He does want to hold up the next panel, which is on US bicameralism. So, Tony, if you just want to remain there, you've got a microphone. Let's see if we can load up some other microphones. Comments, responses, questions?
Professor, did you look at electoral systems? What I was wondering was whether upper houses were more prevalent in countries where there were single-member lower houses, as distinct from proportional representation. Mm-hmm. The point being that upper houses sometimes fulfil the function and representation of allowing groups that don't get represented in the lower house to be represented in the upper house.
No, I didn't, but there are... that's a good point. Well, there are only 18 directly elected upper houses in this kind of global sample of 76. So it would be possible. No, I didn't do that. And I think upper houses have persisted when electoral systems have changed. I mean, if you look at France, I mean, the electoral system has been like a ping pong ball. And the upper house has remained pretty much the same in terms of form and function. So my initial reaction would be I suspect there's not a very strong correlation between electoral systems and kind of the type of upper house.
Other comments, responses, challenges? Yeah.
I would just comment that you say representation is less important. I think it might be at the core of it. If the upper house is going to do anything, it'll be because it somehow represents differently from the lower house. Now, if you take this country, the upper house nominally represents the states. But in fact, of course, we know it doesn't represent the states at all. What it represents is the parties, whereas the lower house doesn't represent the parties. The lower house represents people and places, because the lower house is single-member electorates. And the member from a lower house is going to be basically Labor or Liberal, but he actually represents everyone in his electorate. Whereas when you get a proportional system, the representative is representing an ideology. And so if you're going to satisfy Leiphardt's incongruence requirement, then you're going to have to... But what it seems to me is that you do at the core is that you have... In our system, in our Westminster system, where bicameralism really matters, you have a lower house that's putting up representatives of people and places, and an upper house that's representing interests. And that means interests and ideologies. And that's true whether it's a PR system and they're representing modern left, right, green and what have you, or whether it's representing the aristocracy or a limited franchise system. That means that you really do get a difference if you're set up that way. Anyway, that's just my comment on it.
Well, let me reply with the question. How much do lower house MPs represent a spatial unit, a constituency. I mean, if you look, if there's been work done in Britain, for example, on things like the personal vote, the way that MPs try to cultivate a constituency basis of support that's independent of the constituency's allegiance to the party, and it's not very strong. And so, I mean, are you sure that?
Well, you can argue about this, but you know what the lower house members would like to think. They like to think that they are getting elected because they're popular in their electorate. Now, we know that probably they're getting elected because they were pre-selected by the party. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking of Australia, of course, here. But I think they'd all like to think that they are popular in their electorates. And in country electorates, that may actually be the case. And what you find is that your member, whose preference is to be out there in the electorate looking after people, actually, than being in this institution, which is just a shit fight.
It's a technical term.
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up afterwards.
I mean, what we're on about here is we regard this fight as very important, right? But your member would prefer to be out there. And when somebody comes in, they don't ask, did you vote for me? And if they did know whether that person, when somebody comes for help, you know, I'm having a problem with the Department of God knows what, they don't ask what party they came from. And if they did ask, or if they did infer it somehow, that this person, who this person voted for, whether this person voted for me or not, I think they'd probably be more keen to help somebody who voted for their opponent than voted for them. So they really do represent everyone in their electorate, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, but two fine questions. Thank you very much. you want to use that as an opportunity to help round up now?
Yes. I think the issue is not whether they think they represent their constituents. It's really whether they, for example, break ranks with the party when there is legislation that directly and negatively affects their constituency. I used to teach at University of Cardiff in Wales, and one of the saddest sights ever was when Michael Foot, who represented one of the constituencies in the coal mining valleys, he had to go into his constituency and justify the Labour Party's decision to close down the coal mines. But he voted for it. So, I mean, I would say that for me would be a measure of constituency influence.
Tony, thank you very much.
Okay, John. So John,
please join me in thanking Tony for launching our programme today. Can I invite Phil Larkin to gather his panel together as we take a 90-second break? Thank you so much. That was great.
While Professor Owen gets settled, I'd like to introduce this session on bicameras in the USA. We are lucky to have two very esteemed speakers. on my right, near right, is Dr. Stanley Bach, who spent many years in the many years in the Congressional Research Service in the U.S. Library of Congress. Stan's a acknowledged expert on U.S. legislative politics. He's also, I should add, author of a rather good book on the Australian Senate as well. So he's got a good comparative perspective. There was a platypus on the Parliament, 2003. And if you haven't read it, I would strongly recommend that you do so.
Copies available in the Parliament.
Indeed.
And I don't get any royalties.
On my far right, physically, though not politically, I'm sure, is John Owens, who is a professor of politics at the University of Westminster in London. John is John has primary research interest is in United States politics these days. He's author or editor of a number of books, the most recent being The War on Terrorism, US War on Terrorism, which was published earlier this year. He's also one of the editors of a forthcoming special edition of the Journal of Legislative Studies on the War on Terror in Comparative Perspective, along with Riccardo Palizzo, who's talking later. And I would strongly recommend the definitive contribution on Australia to you all that some bloke has... and that'll be out next year sometime. And the Australia chapter really is worth reading, I can assure you.
Incest.
Anyway, Stan, 25 minutes?
Sure. Or thereabouts.
Also.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here. As you know, in October in Canberra, there are normally two things on which you can rely, one being Floriad and the other being the Bugong moths. Now, I haven't seen any of the moths yet. Have I missed them? So... in the absence of the Bugong moths, you have me returning to Canberra. And I'm delighted to be here, delighted to be back, and I'd like to thank John Ewer for inviting me to be here to participate in this conference. And I also want to thank Harry Evans and all of his colleagues in the Senate for once again offering me their hospitality. This panel is entitled U.S. Bicameralism, Theory and Practice. I'm the theory, John will be the practice, and then we can argue with each other. We're good at that. John Owens, although not an American, probably knows more about the United States Congress than anyone who doesn't permanently reside in the United States. I'm sure you'll enjoy his paper. My paper is in the rear for any of you who are interested in reading it. All I want to try to do is summarize it, which puts me in the unenviable position of trying to do justice to James Madison in about 20 minutes. If I don't resemble a Bugong moth, I assure you I don't resemble James Madison, either in size or in intellect or in eloquence. I'm talking about the Federalist Papers. When John Ewer first mentioned the plans for this conference, I thought it might be interesting to go back and look and see what the Federalist Papers had to say about bicameralism and about the Senate, because the Federalist Papers are one of those things that Americans tend to read when they're too young, like trying to read Crime and Punishment when you're in the eighth grade. You can get through it, but you really don't appreciate it. So it was an opportunity to go back for me to reread some of the Federalist essays, and I must admit I got a different take out of them on this question than I had expected to. There are two ways you can approach this. One is to look at the Federalists in their historical context, see them for what they were intended to be. And the other approach is to take them on face value and look at them as political theory. After they appeared, Thomas Jefferson proclaimed the Federalist, this is the quote, the best commentary on the principles of government which ever was written. Now, it strikes me as a bit hyperbolic, but ironically, the Federalists probably have had more influence in the centuries following their appearance than they did at the time. And I think they've had a profound effect on the way Americans tend to view their Constitution and their system of government. So I'm going to take this second tack and focus mostly on the Federalists as political theory, but I do think it's important to lay a bit of historical context so these things will make sense. When the Constitutional Convention completed its work in Philadelphia in 1787, it then became the task of 13 separate ratifying conventions in each of the states to decide whether or not they would approve this new charter. Well, as Australians remember from their history books about the first efforts to write a Commonwealth Constitution, ratification in the United States in 1788 was not a sure thing. And so three of the leading politicians of the day, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and to a much lesser extent, John Jay, all of whom were skilled attorneys, wrote a series of 85 essays over a period of, what was it, very short period of time, something like 6 or 7 weeks. It was calculated that they produced in, 175,000 words in 7 months, producing roughly four of these essays a week, roughly one every 2 or 3 days. For those of you from the academic world, you have some sense of what a humbling statement that is, that they could be so productive. And these guys could write. Some of their rhetoric is truly impressive. My point is that these essays were written as advocacy documents. They were published in newspapers, and they were intended to shape the thinking and influence the votes of the members of the ratifying conventions, primarily in Virginia and especially in New York, two of the largest and the most influential states, which also happened to be the states which were voting last on the question of ratification. So historically, you have to understand that these essays were written to persuade. They were not written for the purpose of theory, even though much of the way in which they're framed is quite abstract and theoretical. Another thing to bear in mind is that the essays don't necessarily represent what social scientists today would say, call the sincere preferences of their authors. There were aspects of the Constitution which they're now defending as best they can, which both Madison and Hamilton opposed during the proceedings of the Constitutional Convention. Madison, for example, came to Philadelphia advocating the proportional representation of the states in the Senate, and he lost. He also lost on the issue of where sovereignty ultimately would reside. This became one of the real issues in the convention. Ultimately, would sovereignty rest finally with the central government or with the state governments? Because Madison came to Philadelphia operating under the assumption that it had to be one or the other. And in fact, one of the results of the Constitution and one of the things that Madison now defends as an extraordinarily valuable innovation, writing in the Federalist essays, is that instead of saying ultimately sovereignty will be here or there, he said it's both places. The Constitution creates a system of divided or shared sovereignty for which there was no precedent at the time. So the essays were written under a pseudonym of Publius, and in a sense it would be more accurate not to talk about what Madison wrote, but to talk about what Publius wrote, because it is a little bit dangerous simply to attribute everything in the essays that are now attributed to Madison as representing what he truly believed. But it would be so artificial to do that, and since it's Madison, not Hamilton, who wrote the essays that are of particular interest to our subject, I'm going to be talking about Madison. Now, to cut to the chase, Madison does advocate bicameralism, and his reasoning emerges at the end of a fairly extended line of argument, which I'm going to try to sketch briefly. What motivates Madison's thinking is what he describes as a fear of factions. Now, what he meant by faction is just a little bit fuzzy, at least to me, because you have to bear in mind he's writing before the day of interest groups and political parties, as we now know them. He's writing in 1788, and political life was organized in a very different kind of way then. I think Madison would agree if he heard me say that a faction is some group of the politically relevant population, and I say that because we're talking about a period of limited male suffrage. So some segment of that politically relevant population that shares a common interest, but more than that, that recognizes that it shares a common interest, and more than that, organizes themselves, organize together, with the goal of trying to secure control or influence over the institutions of government in order to defend and promote that shared interest. So there's an element of self-consciousness that I think is an essential part of Madison's notion of faction, and you can see how it sort of wobbles on that line between what we now call interest group and what we now call faction. Now, when we use the word faction today, I think we tend instinctively to think in terms of some minority. But in fact, Madison wasn't particularly concerned about the influence of minority factions, because it was his belief that the normal operation of representative government by majority rule would more or less take care of that. Here is in a couple other places. I'm going to quote you because his language is so good. Madison said, "If a faction consists of less than a majority, relief is supplied by the Republican principle, which enables the majority to defeat its sinister views by regular vote. But when a majority is included in a faction, the form of popular government enables it to sacrifice to its ruling passion or interest both the public good and the rights of other citizens." So Madison's concern is the danger of majority factions. And I'll offer an addition. I'll elaborate on Madison's definition by adding something that he doesn't talk about, but what I think is a natural extension of his concern with majority factions. I would add to the possibility of a majority faction the more likely possibility in our day and age of a stable and durable coalition of minority factions that will work in alliance to try to promote their mutual interests by, again, controlling the levers of government power. But to talk about both majority faction and this kind of coalition becomes rhetorically too complicated, so I'm going to continue to talk about majority factions, but I really have both of these in mind. Madison's concern is the tyranny of the majority. And as I think became clear from some of the conversations yesterday, the American Constitution, when it was written, was far from being a majoritarian document. And if it were presented to us today without knowing where it came from, we might very well say, well, it really doesn't meet the standards of contemporary democratic theory. After all, it was only the House of Representatives that was to be directly elected. The Senate was to be elected by the state legislatures from among the great and good in each state. And the president was to be elected by an electoral college, which continues to be the case, except the way in which the framers conceived of the electoral college is a great deal different from the kind of non-entities that electors become today. The thought was that in this, by standards of the time, large country where communication was very difficult, a farmer in the Carolinas would have absolutely no way to be able to gauge the qualifications of a New Yorker as a potential president. So you had to rely on the judgment of those people who were in communication from state to state with each other and who did know something about the potential worth of possible presidential candidates. So it was hardly a majoritarian document. The other point I want to emphasize is in that quote I read you, Madison refers to the effect of a majority faction on both the public good and the rights of other citizens. Madison doesn't equate the interests of the majority with the national interest. He is referring both to the real and legitimate interests of a possible majority faction, but also to the real and legitimate interests of minority factions, and also apparently of some public good above and beyond the interests of any of these factions. You know, this could lead us down, you know, the Rousseau path, and we could talk about the general will being versus the will of all, but I won't go there because I'm not competent to do it anymore. Suffice it to say that Madison does not equate the public interest, the national interest, what he called the public good, with the interests of a possible majority faction. So majoritarianism is not satisfying. So imagine, if you will, that we've got the institutions of government power, maybe, you know, sitting on a hill, and you have this majority faction or our coalition of minority factions in alliance trying to capture that government power so that they can use it to preserve and promote their own interests. Madison sees in the Constitution a defense against that happening. He sees in it a series of bulwarks, or what I'll talk about in terms of lines of defense. In other words, he sees in the process of institutional design, or what people sometimes today talk about constitutional engineering, as a way of protecting against the danger of the majority faction, the tyranny of the majority. When I first read these papers, I started thinking that what Madison was really concerned about was corruption and people using power of government to their personal benefit. And I think that was a simplistic reading of what Madison had in mind. I think what he was as concerned with is not just the fear of people using power for corrupt purposes and for individual benefit, but I think he was also concerned about what I think of as a kind of natural selfishness and myopia in man, that there are limits to our imagination and our empathy with regard to others in our society, and the ease with which we manage to equate in our own minds what's in our interest with what's in the national interest. This is something that I know our politicians are extraordinarily adept at. They rarely see a contradiction between what they believe and what their constituents want them to do because they naturally see an identity there. And it's only when they are very seriously mistaken that they're likely to be defeated. So I think Madison's concerned about a natural tendency for people to equate their self-interest with the national interest. And this, I think, more than the danger of personal corruption, is the danger that Madison sees in the power of the majority. So, what are these lines of defense that he creates? Well, the first is the very size of the republic. And one of the innovations in Madison's argument is that he turns on its head the conventional notion of under what circumstances a democracy is likely to flourish. The traditional notion was, well, a democracy has to be, you know, the Athenian polity. It has to be a small geographical area and a relatively small population. But Madison said, wait a minute, we're not creating a democracy. We're creating a republic. And in our conventional discourse, we tend to equate the two. And Madison was not going to do that. Instead, he argued that, in fact, the larger the republic, the greater protection is offered against the possibility of that majority faction forming, because with size and greater population comes greater heterogeneity, greater diversity, more interests, and therefore more factions and a lesser likelihood of a single faction taking control of the government. So, size, the first line of defense. The second line of defense, federalism. What I've sometimes heard described as a vertical separation of powers, the kind of divided sovereignty to which I referred earlier, where the Constitution, in a sense, gives some powers to each of the states against the other states, and also creates a division between the states collectively and the central government. With this circumstance, it's not enough for a faction to take control of one set of government institutions, because there are now, in the United States today, you could say 51 of them. You've got the institutions of government in each of the 50 states, and they are sovereign with respect to a variety of matters. And then, of course, you've got my former masters in Washington. So the second line of defense, federalism, a vertical separation of powers. The third line of defense, what we more normally think of as separation of powers, what Madison would probably call a horizontal separation of powers. But what he meant, of course, was not separation of powers literally, but in Richard Neustadt's later formulation, separated institutions sharing the powers of government. In one of the Federalist Papers, he takes on the criticism that the new Constitution really didn't separate powers. You had this intermingling of powers. The legislative power shared by the Congress and the President, the appointment power shared by the President and the Congress, and so on. And Madison said, wait a minute, that's not a flaw in the Constitution. That is precisely its strength. I quote you again. This is so good, I'll take a minute to quote a paragraph. Madison said, the great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and the personal motives to resist encroachments of the others. The provision for defense must, in this, as in all other cases, be made commensurate to the danger of the attack. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. He is saying that if a government official realizes that his or her power and influence depends on the continuing strength and autonomy of the institution in which that person serves, now we are connecting the ambitions of the individual with the powers of the place, and you know, the president will protect the prerogatives of the presidency in order to preserve and enhance his own power, and so will the members of Congress. So that you will have the members of government protecting the allocation of powers in the government, not out of some sense of abstract obligation, but for the most personal of motives, to protect their own power. So, he says what the Constitution does is to create a balance of power within the national government. However, and this is where it gets more relevant to our concerns, he asks in effect, but what happens if the branches are not equally and sufficiently powerful to withstand what he calls the encroaching nature of power? What if one branch of government is sufficiently powerful that it can overwhelm the others? Then there is no effective balance of power and the system falls. So far, so good. Madison says that danger of a dominant branch was the legislature. He talks about the inexorable flow of power into the vortex of the legislature. He sees the legislature as being the dangerous branch of government, the one most likely to overwhelm the executive and the judiciary. Now, to us today, that may sound quaint and anachronistic, but I want you to suspend your disbelief for just a minute, because this gets us finally to bicameralism. To Madison, bicameralism represents that fourth and final line of defense. If it's the legislature that's the greatest danger, then you limit that danger by dividing the legislature against itself, so that you create two halves of it which are unlikely to act together, and therefore you sufficiently weaken the legislature so that it's much less likely to be able to overwhelm the executive and surely the judiciary. But that only works if the two branches of the legislature are sufficiently different. And Madison says it's necessary to divide the legislature into different branches and to render them by different modes of election and different principles of action as little connected with each other as the nature of their common functions and their common dependence on the society will admit. Now, if we stop there, we can say, well, this is all interesting historically, but since we're not fearing legislatures today, it's not particularly relevant. However, if you take the premise of his argument, he's assuming that the branches of government will protect their own powers and protect themselves against encroachments. Today, if he were writing, I think he'd ask, what if the branches of government don't try to protect themselves against one of the others? What if there, in fact, is an alliance between two or more of the branches of government so that a single faction could, in fact, gain control? Madison doesn't talk very much about this because I don't think he really contemplated the possibility, because he was writing before the emergence of political parties. Political parties that create bridges across some of the chasms, the institutional chasms that the Constitution created, and parties that can transform calculations of personal ambition so that politicians can say, well, if I want to protect and promote my own personal ambition, it is important to me not to be so concerned with the power of my institution as with the power of the party of which I'm a member. So I think Madison would argue, last paragraph, that if you have the same party or the same coalition of stable and durable factions controlling separated institutions, sharing the powers of government, that we are in fact confronted with exactly the danger of majoritarianism that Madison feared and that was a point at which we began the argument, meaning that bicameralism is even more important under these circumstances than it was when Madison was writing 200 years ago, but only in Leaphart's term, Aaron Leaphart, to whom Tony referred, only if the two branches are, correct me if I get this wrong, symmetrical and incongruent, meaning basically they have equal powers, but they are constructed in ways which encourage them to use those powers in different ways. What Madison had in mind when he said that they have different modes of election, different principles of action, and are as little connected with each other as the nature of their common functions and their common dependence on the society will admit. Full stop. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's fine. Bit of coordination required here.
First of all, let me also thank John Muir for inviting me to this fascinating conference and for facilitating my return to Australia. I also welcome being on a panel with my good friend Stan, who is not only a good friend, but my eternal expert on congressional procedure. As you can see, my title is Bicameralism, Strategic Interaction and Lawmaking Within the Contemporary Context, the U.S. House and Senate in an Era of Polarized Partisanship. The strategic interaction in contemporary lawmaking in Washington, or the strategic interactions, plural, are really complicated. So if I make it to the end of my presentation in the time available, it's going to be a minor miracle. The effects of bicameralism are all too evident in contemporary Washington politics. One only has to think back last year to the efforts of congressional Democrats to require the president to withdraw U.S. Troops from Iraq. The House of Representatives found it fairly easy to pass legislation that would set political benchmarks for the Iraqi government and the Bush administration. Unless the benchmarks were met, the president would have to redeploy U.S. troops from Iraq within 6 months and withdraw all of them by 2008. In the Senate, where the Democrats enjoyed a majority of only two, a coalition of almost all the Republicans and a few Democrats balked at confronting the president and demanding troop withdrawal. Not only, then, does it matter that a governmental system has two legislative chambers rather than one, it also matters what powers the chambers have in respect to one another, how each of the chambers is organized, and what the pattern of relations between the two chambers is. Bicameralism in Washington makes it highly likely that when major legislation is at issue, the House and the Senate will produce different legislative outcomes. This means, of course, that chamber, or more accurately, the leaders of each chamber, that each chamber has needed to adjust its political strategies to accommodate, to compete, or confront the other chamber. To understand how bicameralism affects the process of lawmaking in Washington, this means that we need to examine not only how each of the separate chambers behave separately, but also how they interact with one another.